In 8 Book 1, I sing of arms and of the man fated to be an exile, who long since left the land of Troy and came to Italy to the shores of Lavinium, and a great pounding he took by land and sea at the hands of the heavenly gods because of the fierce and unforgetting anger of Juno. Great, too, were his sufferings in war before he could found his city and carry his gods into Latium. This was the beginning of the Latin race, the Alban fathers and the high walls of Rome. Tell me, Muse, the causes of her anger. How did he violate the will of the Queen of the Gods? What was his offence? Why did she drive a man famous for his piety to such endless hardship and such suffering? Can there be so much anger in the hearts of the heavenly gods? There was an ancient city held by colonists from Tyre, opposite Italy and the distant mouth of the river Tiber. It was a city of great wealth and ruthless in the pursuit of war. Its name was Carthage, and Juno is said to have loved it more than any other place, more even than Samos. Here the goddess kept her armour. Here was her chariot, and this was the city she had long favoured, intending to give it sovereignty over the peoples of the earth, if only the fates would allow it. But she had heard that there was rising from the blood of Troy a race of men who in days to come would overthrow this Tyrian citadel. A people proud in war and rulers of a great empire would come to sack the land of Libya. This is the destiny the fates were unrolling. These were the fears of the daughter of Saturn. And she had not forgotten the war that she had fought long since at Troy for her beloved Argos, nor had her bitter resentment and the reasons for it ever left her mind. There still rankled deep in her heart the judgment of Paris and the injustice of the slight to her beauty, her loathing for the whole stock of Dardanus, and her fury at the honours done to Ganymede, whom her husband Jupiter had carried off to be his cupbearer. With all this fueling her anger, she was keeping the remnants of the Trojans, those who had escaped the savagery of Achilles and the Greeks, far away from Latium, driven by the fates to wander year after year round all the oceans of the world. So heavy was the cost of founding the Roman race. The Trojans were in high spirits. They were almost out of sight of Sicily and heading for the open sea, with the wind astern and their bronze prows churning the salt sea to foam, as Juno brooded, still nursing the eternal wound deep in her breast. Am I to admit defeat and give up my attempt to keep the king of the Trojans away from Italy? So the fates do not approve. Yet Pallas Athene could fire the fleet and drown my own Argives in the sea because of the guilt of one man, the mad passion of Ajax, son of Oileus. With her own hand she threw the consuming fire of Jupiter from the clouds, shattering his ships and sending winds to churn up the level sea. Then, as he breathed out flame from his breast where the thunderbolt had pierced it, she caught him up in a whirlwind and impaled him on a jagged rock. But here am I, the queen of the gods, the sister of Jupiter and his wife, and I have waged war all these years against a whole race of men. Is there no one left who worships the godhead of Juno? Will there be no one in the future to pray to me and lay an offering on my altars? These are the thoughts the goddess turned over in her burning heart as she came to Aeolia, the home of the clouds, a place teeming with the raging winds of the south. here, Aeolus is king, and here, in a vast cavern, he keeps in subjection the brawling winds and howling storms, chained and bridled in their prison. They murmur in loud protest round bolted gates in the mountainside, while Aeolus sits in his high citadel holding his sceptre, soothing their spirits and tempering their angry passions. But for him, they would catch up the sea, the earth and the deeps of the sky and sweep them along through space. In fear of this, the all-powerful father banished them to these black caverns with massive mountains heaped over them, and gave them, under a fixed charter, a king who knew how to hold them in check, or, when ordered, to let them run with free rein. It was to him that Juno made supplication in these words. "I come to you, Aeolus, because the father of the gods and king of men has given you the power to calm the waves of the sea or raise them by your winds. A race of men hateful to me is sailing the Tyrrhenian Sea, carrying Ilium to Italy, along with the Penates, their defeated gods. Whip up your winds, overwhelm their ships and sink them. Drive their fleet in all directions and scatter their bodies over the sea. I have 14 nymphs of the rarest beauty, and the loveliest of them all is Deipea. I shall make her yours and join you in lawful wedlock. If you do me this service, she shall spend all her years with you and make you the father of beautiful children." To this Aeolus made answer, "Your task, O queen, is to decide your wishes. My duty is to carry out your orders. It is thanks to you that I rule this little kingdom and enjoy this sceptre and the blessing of Jupiter. Through you, I have a couch to lie on at the feasts of the gods, and my power over cloud and storm comes from you." At these words, he struck the side of the hollow mountain with the butt of his spear, and the winds seemed to form a column and pour out through an open gate to blow a hurricane over the whole earth. The east wind and the south and the southwest with its squalls all fell upon the sea at once, whipping it up from its bottommost depths and rolling huge waves towards its shores. Men shouted, ropes screamed, clouds suddenly blotted out the light of the sky from the eyes of the Trojans, and black night brooded over the sea as the heavens thundered and lightning flashed again and again across the sky. Wherever the Trojans looked, death stared them in the face. A sudden chill went through Aeneas, and his limbs grew weak. Groaning, he lifted his hands palm upwards to the stars and cried, "Those whose fate it was to die beneath the high walls of Troy, with their fathers looking down on them, were many, many times more fortunate than I. O Diomede, bravest of the Greeks, why could I not have fallen to your right hand and breathed out my life on the plains of Troy, where fierce Hector was killed by the sword of Achilles, where great Sarpedon lies, and where the river Simois caught up so many shields and helmets and bodies of brave men and rolled them down its current?" Even as he threw out these words, a squall came howling from the north, catching his sail full on and raising the waves to the stars. The oars broke, the prow was wrenched round, and as they lay beam on to the seas, there came towering over them a sheer mountain of water. Some of the ships were hanging on the crests of the waves. For others, the waters opened, and in the troughs could be seen the seabed and the seething sand. Three of them were caught by the south wind and driven off course onto a reef hidden in mid-ocean. Italians know it as the Altars. A huge spine of rock just under the surface. Three of them the southeaster took and carried helplessly from the high sea onto the sandbanks of the Syrtes, ran them aground and blocked them in with walls of sand. Before the very eyes of Aeneas, the ship that carried the faithful Orontes and his Lycians was struck on the stern by a great sea, and the helmsman was swept away head first into the water. Three times she spun round on the same spot, till the swift whirlpool sucked her down. Here and there, men could be seen swimming in the vast ocean, and with them in the waves their armour, spars of wood, and the treasures of Troy. One by one, the stout ships of Ilioneus and brave Achates, then Abas and old Aletes, succumbed to the storm. The fastenings of the ship's sides were loosened, the deadly water poured in, and the timbers sprang. Neptune, meanwhile, observed the loud disturbance of the ocean, the release of storms, the draining of his deepest pools, and was moved to anger. Rising from the depths, he lifted his head high above the crests of the waves and looked serenely out over the sea at Aeneas's fleet scattered over the face of the waters, and the Trojans overwhelmed by the waves and by the rending of the sky. He recognised at once the anger and the cunning of his sister Juno, and he instantly summoned the east wind and the west and spoke to them in these words. "Is it your noble birth that has made you so sure of yourselves? Do you winds now dare to move heaven and earth and to raise these great masses of water without my divine authority? I could take you now and... But first I must still the waves you have stirred up. For any crimes you commit in the future, you will pay a dearer price. Away with you, and take this message to your king. He is not the one who has jurisdiction over the sea, or holds the trident that knows no pity. That is my responsibility, given to me by lot. His domain, O Eurus, wind of the east, is the huge crags where you have your home. That is where Aeolus can do his swaggering, confining his rule to the closed walls of the prison of the winds." These were his words, and before he had finished speaking, he was calming the swell, dispersing the banked clouds and bringing back the sun. Triton and the sea nymph Chimophoe heaved and strained as they pushed the ships off jagged rocks, while Neptune himself lifted them out of the sandbanks with his trident and opened up the vast Syrtes. Restraining the sea, as he skimmed along with his chariot wheels touching the crests of the waves. As when disorder arises among the people of a great city, and the common mob runs riot, wild passion finds weapons for men's hands, and torches and rocks start flying. At such a time, if people chance to see a man who has some weight among them for his goodness and his services to the state, they fall silent, standing and listening with all their attention, while his words command their passions and soothe their hearts. So did all the crashing of the sea fall silent, and Father Neptune, looking out over the waves, drove the horses of his chariot beneath a clear sky and gave them rein to fly before the wind. Aeneas and his men were exhausted, and making what speed they could for the nearest land, they set course for the coast of Libya. There is a place where a harbour is formed by an island blocking the mouth of a long sound. As the waves come in from the open sea and break on the sides of this island, they are divided into the deep inlets of the bay. Rock cliffs are everywhere. A great pinnacle threatens the sky on either side, and beneath all this, the broad water lies still and safe. At the end of the bay, there rises a backcloth of shimmering trees, a dark wood with quivering shadows looming over the water. And there, at the foot of this scene, is a cave of hanging rocks, a home for the nymphs, with fresh spring water inside it and seats in the virgin rock. Here there is no need of chains to moor the weary ships, or of anchors with hooked teeth to hold them fast. This is where Aeneas put in with his 7 ships gathered from all the Trojan fleet, and great was their longing for the land as they disembarked and stepped at last onto the shore and threw their sea-wasted bodies down onto the sand. First of all, Achates struck a spark from the flint, caught it in some leaves, fed the flame by putting dry twigs round it, and set the fire going with brushwood. Then, weary as they were after all their labours, they laid out their corn, the gift of the goddess Ceres, all tainted with salt, and the goddess's own implements, and set themselves to scorch with flame this grain they have saved from the sea, and to grind it on stone. Meanwhile, Aeneas climbed a rock to get a view over the whole breadth of the ocean and see if there was any trace of the storm-tossed Antheus or of the double-banked Trojan galleys, Capys perhaps, or Caiacus's armour high on the poop. There was not a ship to be seen. But he did see 3 stags wandering about the shore with all their herd behind them grazing the low ground in a long line. He stopped in his tracks and snatched his bow and swift arrows from the trusty Achates. First, he took down the 3 leaders with their high heads of branching antlers. The whole of the rest of the herd scattered into the leafy cover of the wood, but not before he succeeded in stretching 7 huge carcasses on the ground, 1 for each of the ships. He then made for the harbour and gave them out to all his men. Last of all, he shared out the wine the good Acestes, with a hero's generosity, had poured into casks for them as they left the shores of Sicily. Then, as they mourned, he comforted them, saying, "My friends, this is not the first trouble we have known. We have suffered worse before, and this too will pass. God will see to it. You have been to Scylla's cave and heard the mad dogs howling in the depths of it. You have even survived rocks thrown by the Cyclops. So, summon up your courage once again. This is no time for gloom or fear. The day will come, perhaps, when it will give you pleasure to remember even this. Whatever chance may bring, however many hardships we suffer, we are making for Latium, where the fates show us our place of rest. There it is the will of God that the kingdom of Troy shall rise again. Your task is to endure and save yourselves for better days. These were his words, but he was sick with all his cares. He showed them the face of hope, and he kept his misery deep in his heart. His men went briskly to work, preparing the coming feast. They flayed the hide off the ribs and exposed the flesh. Some cut it into quivering slices and speared it on spits. Others laid out cauldrons of water on the shore and lit fires. Then at last they ate and recovered their strength, lying on the grass and taking their fill of old wine and rich venison. When their hunger was satisfied and the remains of the feast removed, they talked at length about their missing comrades, not knowing whether to hope or fear, wondering whether they were still alive, or whether at that very moment they were drawing their last breath and beyond all calling. Most of all did Aeneas, who loved his men, mourn to himself the loss of eager Orontes and Amycus, and the cruel death of Lycus, then brave Gaius and brave Cloanthus. Now the feast was ended, and Jupiter was looking down from the height of heaven on the sea flying with sails, and the land far beneath him, on the shores of the seas and the far-spread peoples, when suddenly he stopped in his survey at the highest point of the sky and fixed his eyes upon the kingdom of Libya. Even as he was turning over in his mind all the suffering that he saw, his daughter Venus came to him, her shining eyes brimming with tears, and spoke with a sadness greater than his own. "You who rule the affairs of gods and men with your eternal law, and at whose lightning we are all afraid, what great harm has my son Aeneas been able to do to you? What crime have the Trojans committed that they should suffer all this loss of life and the whole world be closed to them for the sake of Italy? Did you not promise that with the rolling years there would come a time when from this stock the Romans would arise? From this blood of Teucer, recalled to Italian soil, there would come leaders of men who would hold power over every land and sea. Oh, father, father, has some argument changed your mind? As for me, I used to console myself with this for the cruel fall and sack of Troy by weighing one destiny against another. But unrelieved misfortune is now hounding these men from disaster to disaster. Oh, great king, what end do you set to their labours? The Greeks were all around Antenor, but he escaped them, made his way safely to the Illyrian Gulf and the heartlands of the kingdom of the Liburnians, and then went beyond the mouth of the Timavus. From there, with a great roar from inside the mountain, a sea of water bursts out of nine mouths and covers the fields with a sounding ocean. But in this place he founded the city of Patavium as a home for his Trojans and gave them a name. There he dedicated the arms with which he fought at Troy, and there he now lives in settled peace and quiet. But as for us, your own children, to whom you grant a place in the citadel of heaven, we lose our ships. It is unspeakable. We are betrayed and kept far away from the shores of Italy because there is one who hates us. Is this our reward for piety and obedience? Is this how you bring us to our kingdom? The father of gods and men, looking at his daughter with the smile that clears the sky and dispels the storms, kissed her lightly on the lips and said, "Spare yourself these fears, my lady from Kythera. The destiny of your descendants remains unchanged. You will see the city of Lavinium and its promised walls. You will take great-hearted Aeneas up to the stars of heaven. No argument changes my mind. But now, since you are tormented by this anxiety, I shall tell you more, unrolling for you the secrets of the scroll of the fates. He will wage a great war in Italy and crush its fierce tribes. He will build walls for his people and establish their way of life until a third summer has seen him reigning in Latium and a third winter has passed after the subjection of the Rutulians, a tribe in Italy. But the reign of his son Ascanius, who now receives the second name Eulus, it was Elus while the kingdom of Ilium still stood. This reign shall last while 30 long years revolve, and he, Aeneas' son, shall transfer his kingdom from its seat at Lavinium and build a city with powerful fortifications at Alba Longa. Here, the rule of the race of Hector will last for 300 long years, until Elia, the royal priestess, heavy with the seed of Mars, shall give birth to twin sons. Then Romulus shall receive the people, wearing with joy the tawny hide of the wolf which nursed him. The walls he builds will be the walls of Mars, and he shall give his own name to his people, the Romans. On them I impose no limits of time or place. I have given them an empire that will know no end. Even angry Juno, who is now wearying sea and land and sky with her terrors, will come to better counsel and join with me in cherishing the people of Rome, the rulers of the world, the race that wears the toga. So it has been decreed. There will come a day, as the years glide by, when the house of Assaracus will reduce Achilles, Phthia, and glorious Mycenae to slavery, and will conquer and rule the city of Argos. From this noble stock there will be born a Trojan Caesar. This is Augustus. To bound his empire by Oceanus at the limits of the world, and his fame by the stars. He will be called Julius, a name passed down to him from the great Eulus, Aeneas' son. In time to come, have no fear, you will receive him, Augustus, in the sky, laden with the spoils of the East. He too will be called upon in prayer. Then wars will be laid aside and the years of bitterness will be over. Silver-haired Truth and Vesta, a Trojan goddess, and Romulus Quirinus with his brother Remus will sit dispensing justice. The dread gates of war with their tight fastenings of steel will then be closed, and godless Strife will sit inside them on his murderous armour, roaring hideously from bloody mouth, hands shackled behind his back with 100 bands of bronze. So spoke Jupiter. And he sent down Mercury, the son of Maia, to make the lands and the citadel of the new city of Carthage hospitable to the Trojans, in case Dido, that's the queen of Carthage, in her ignorance of destiny, should bar her country to them. Through the great expanse of air he flew, wielding his wings like oars, and soon alighted on the shores of Libya. There he lost no time in carrying out the commands of Jupiter, and in accordance with the divine will, the Carthaginians laid aside their fiery temper. Most of all, the queen took into her heart a feeling of quiet and kindness towards the Trojans. But all that night, the dutiful Aeneas was turning many things over in his mind. As soon as life-giving morning came, he decided to go out and explore this new land and bring back to his men a true account of the shores to which the winds had driven him, and the beasts and men who lived there, if there were any men, for he saw no signs of cultivation. So, leaving his ships hidden in the wooded cove under the overhanging rocks, and shut in on every side by trees and quivering shade, he set out alone with Achates, gripping two broad-bladed steel spears in his hand. As he walked through the middle of the wood, his mother came to meet him, looking like a Spartan girl out hunting, wearing the dress of a Spartan girl and carrying her weapons, or like the Thracian Harpalyce, as she wearies horses with her running and outstrips the swift current of the river Hebrus. She had a light bow hanging from her shoulders in hunting style. Her hair was unbound and streaming in the wind, and her flowing dress was caught up above the knee. "Hey there, soldiers," she called out to them. "Do you happen to have seen one of my sisters wandering about here, or in full cry after the foaming boar? She was wearing a spotted lynx skin and had a quiver hanging from her belt." So spoke Venus, and Venus's son, so began his reply. "I have neither seen nor heard any of your sisters, but how am I to address a girl like you? Your face is not the face of a mortal, and you do not speak like a human being. Surely you must be a goddess. Are you Diana, sister of Apollo? Are you one of the sister nymphs? Be gracious to us, whoever you may be, and lighten our distress. Tell us what sky this is we now find ourselves beneath. What shore of the world is this on which we now wander, tossed here by the fury of wind and wave? We do not know the place. We do not know the people. Tell us, and many a victim will fall by my right hand before your altars." Venus replied, "I am sure I deserve no such honour. Tyrian girls all carry the quiver and wear purple boots with this high ankle binding. This is a Phoenician kingdom you're looking at. We are Tyrians. This is the city of the people of Agenor, but the land belongs to the Libyans, a race not easy to handle in war. Dido, who came from the city of Tyre to escape her brother, holds sway here. There was a crime long ago. It is a long and winding story, but I shall trace its outlines for you. Her father had given her in marriage to Sychaeus, the wealthiest of the Phoenicians. They were joined with all the due rites of a first marriage, and great was the love the poor queen bore for him. But the kingdom of Tyre was ruled by her brother Pygmalion, the vilest of criminals. A mad passion came between the two men. In blind lust for his gold, the godless Pygmalion attacked him without warning, ambushing him at the altar. With no thought for his sister's love, he killed Sychaeus, and for a long time concealed what he had done. Dido was sick with love, and he deceived her with false hopes and empty pretenses. But one night there appeared to her in a dream the very ghost of her unburied husband. He lifted up his face, pale with the strange pallor of the dead, and bearing the sword wounds on his breast, he pointed to the altar where he had been killed and revealed the whole horror of the crime that had been hidden in their house. He then urged her to escape with all speed from their native land, and to help her on her wanderings, he showed her where to find an ancient treasure buried in the earth. An incalculable weight of silver and gold. This moved Dido to plan her escape and gather followers, men driven by savage hatred or lively fear of the tyrant, her brother Pygmalion. They seized some ships which happened to be ready for sea. They loaded them with gold and sailed away with the wealth Pygmalion had coveted. The woman led the whole undertaking. When they arrived at the place where you will now see the great walls and rising citadel of the new city of Carthage, they bought a piece of land called the Bursa, the animal's hide, as large an area as they could include within the hide of a bull. But now tell me, who are you? What country have you sailed from? Where are you making for? In reply to her questions, Aeneas drew a great sigh from the bottom of his heart and said, "O goddess, if I were to start at the beginning and retrace our whole story, and if you had the time to listen to the annals of our suffering before I finish, the doors of Olympus would close and the evening star would lay the day to rest. We come from the ancient city of Troy, if the name of Troy has ever reached your ears. We have sailed many seas, and by the chance of the winds, we have been driven ashore here in Libya. I am Aeneas, known for my devotion. I carry with me on my ships the gods of my home, the Penates, wrested from my enemies. And my fame has reached beyond the skies. I am searching for my fatherland in Italy. My descent is from highest Jupiter. With my goddess mother to show the way, I embarked upon the Phrygian Sea with 20 ships, following the destiny which had been given to me. And now a bare 7 of them remain, and these torn to pieces by wind and wave. I am a helpless stranger, driven out of Europe and out of Asia, tramping the desert wastes of Libya." Venus could listen to no more. She broke in on the tale of his sufferings, saying, "Whoever you are, you breathe the breath of life, and you have come to this Tyrian city. I do not believe you are hated by the gods. Go on now from here to the queen's door. I can tell you that your comrades are restored and your fleet returned to you. The winds have veered to the north and blown them safe to shore. All this is true. Unless my parents have failed in their efforts to teach me to interpret the flight of birds, look at those 12 swans flying joyfully in formation. The eagle of Jupiter was swooping down on them from the heights of heaven and scattering them over the open sky. But now look at them in their long column. Some are reaching land. Some have already reached it and are looking down on it. Just as they have come to their home and their flock has circled the sky in play, singing as they fly with whirring wings. So your ships and your warriors are either already in port or crossing the bar in full sail. Go on now and follow where the road takes you." When she had finished speaking and was turning away, her neck shone with a rosy light and her hair breathed the divine odour of ambrosia. Her dress flowed free to her feet, and as she walked, he knew she was truly a goddess. As she hastened away, he recognised her as his mother and called after her, "Why do you so often mock your own son by taking on these disguises? You too are cruel. Why am I never allowed to take your hand in mine, to hear your true voice and to speak to you as you really are?" With these reproaches, he took the road that led to the city. But Venus hedged them about with a thick mist as they walked. The goddess spread a great veil of cloud over them, so that no one could see them or touch them or cause any delay or ask the reason for their coming. She herself soared high into the sky and departed for Paphos, returning happily to her beloved home where she has her temple, and 100 altars steam with the incense of Sheba and breathe the fragrance of fresh-cut flowers. Meanwhile, Aeneas and Achates hurried on their way, following the track, and they were soon climbing the great hill which towered over the city and looked down upon the citadel opposite. Aeneas was amazed by the size of it, where recently there had been nothing but shepherds' huts, amazed too by the gates, the paved streets, and all the stir. The Tyrians were working with a will. Some of them were laying out the line of walls or rolling up great stones for building the citadel. Others were choosing sites for building and marking them out with the plough. Others were drawing up laws and electing magistrates and a senate whom they could revere. On one side they were excavating a harbour. On the other, laying deep foundations for a theatre and quarrying huge columns from the rock to make a handsome backdrop for the stage that was to be. They were like bees at the beginning of summer, busy in the sunshine all through the flowery meadows, bringing out the young of the race just come of age, or treading the oozing honey and swelling the cells with sweet nectar, or taking the loads as they come in, or mounting guard to keep the herds of idle drones out of their farmstead. The hive seethes with activity, and the fragrance of honey flavoured with thyme is everywhere. "How fortunate they are," cried Aeneas, now looking up at the high tops of the buildings. "Their walls are already rising." And he moved on through the middle of the people, hedged about by the miraculous cloud, and no one saw him. There was a wooded grove which gave abundant shade in the middle of the city. When first the Phoenicians had been driven there by wind and wave, Juno, the queen of the gods, had led them to this spot, where they had dug up the head of a spirited stallion, a horse. This was a sign that from generation to generation they would be a race glorious in war and would have no difficulty in finding fields to graze. Here Sidonian Dido was building for Juno a huge temple rich with offerings and rich too with the presence of the goddess. It was a raised temple, and at the top of its steps the threshold was of bronze, The beams were jointed with bronze, and the bronze doors grated as they turned in their sockets. Here in this grove, Aeneas saw a strange sight, which for the first time allayed his fears. Here, for the first time, he dared to hope. And despite all the calamities of the past, to have better confidence in the future. While waiting for the queen and studying everything there was to see under the roof of this huge temple, as he marvelled at the good fortune of the city, the skill of the workmen and all the works of their hands, he suddenly saw laid out in order depictions of the battles fought at Troy as decorations on the temple. The two sons of Atreus were there, and Priam, and Achilles, who hated both sides. Aeneas stopped and wept and said to Achates, "Is there anywhere now on the face of this earth that is not full of the knowledge of our misfortunes? Look at Priam. Here too there is just reward for merit. There are tears for suffering, and men's hearts are touched by what man has to bear. Forget your fears. We are known here. This will give you some hope for the future." As he spoke these words, he was feeding his spirit with the empty images and groaning, and rivers of tears washed down his cheeks as he gazed at the fighting round the walls of Troy. On one side, Greeks were in flight with Trojan warriors hard on their heels. On the other, Trojans were retreating, and Achilles with his crested helmet was pursuing them in his chariot. He wept too when he recognised the white canvas of the tents of Rhesus nearby. It was the first sleep of the night. The tents had been betrayed and were being torn down by Diomede, red with the blood of all the men he had slaughtered. He stole the fiery horses and took them back to the Greek camp before they could crop the grass of Troy or drink the water of the Xanthus River. In another part of the picture, poor Troilus, a mere boy and no match for Achilles, had lost his armour and was in full flight. His horses had run away with the chariot and he was being dragged along, helpless on his back behind it, still holding on to the reins. His neck and hair were trailing along the ground and the end of his spear was scoring the dust behind him. The women of Troy, meanwhile, were going in supplication to the temple of Pallas Athene. But the goddess was hostile to them. Their hair was unbound, and they were carrying a robe to offer her, beating their breasts in grief. But her head was turned from them, and her eyes were fixed upon the ground. There, too, was Achilles. He had dragged Hector three times round the walls of Troy and now was selling his dead body for gold. Aeneas groaned from the depths of his heart to see the armour stripped off him, the chariot, the corpse of his dear friend, and Priam stretching out his feeble hands. Aeneas even recognised himself in the confusion of battle, with the leaders of the Greeks all around him. There were the warriors of the east, the armour of Memnon and his dark skin. The Amazons were there in their thousands with crescent shields, and their leader, Penthesilea, in the middle of her army, ablaze with passion for war. There, showing her naked breast, supported by a band of gold, was the warrior maiden, daring to clash with men in battle. While Trojan Aeneas stood gazing, rooted to the spot and lost in amazement at what he saw. Queen Dido, in all her beauty, arrived at the temple with a great crowd of warriors all around her. She was like Diana leading the dance on the banks of the Eurotas River, or along the ridges of Mount Kynthus, with 1,000 mounted nymphs thronging behind her on either side. She carries her quiver on her shoulder, and as she walks, she is the tallest of all the goddesses. Her mother Latona does not speak, but a great joy stirs her heart at the sight of her. Dido was like Diana, and like Diana she bore herself joyfully among her people, urging on their work for the kingdom that was to be. Then she sat on her high throne under the coffered roof, in the middle of the temple before the doors of the shrine of the goddess. There, as she was giving laws and rules of conduct to her people, and dividing the work that had to be done in equal parts, or allocating it by lot, Aeneas suddenly saw a great throng approaching. Antheus, Segestus, brave Cloanthus, and the other Trojans who had been scattered over the sea by the dark storm and swept away to distant shores. He was astounded, and Achates too was stunned with joy and fear. They burned with longing to clasp the hands of their comrades, but were at a loss because they did not understand what they saw. They did nothing but stayed hidden in their cloak of cloud, waiting to learn how fortune had dealt with their comrades. On what shore had they left their fleet? Why were they here? For these were picked men coming from each of the ships to plead their case, and they were now walking to the temple, with shouting all about them. They came in and were allowed to address the queen. Ilioneus, the older of them, made this appeal. You are a queen whom Jupiter has allowed to found a new city and curb proud peoples with your justice. We are the unhappy men of Troy, blown by the winds over all the oceans of the world, and we come to you as suppliants. Save our ships from the impious threat of fire. We are God-fearing men. Take pity on us. Look more closely at us. We have not come to Libya to pillage your homes and their gods, to take plunder and drive it down to the shore. Such violence and arrogance are not to be found in the hearts of the defeated. There is a place which Greeks know by the name Hesperia. It is an ancient land, strong in war and rich in the fertility of its soil. It was once tilled by Oenotrians, but now we believe their descendants have called themselves Italians after their king Italus. This is where we were steering, when suddenly Orion rose in cloud and tempest and drove us onto hidden shallows. The sea overwhelmed us, and fierce southerly squalls scattered us far and wide among breakers and uncharted rocks. A few of us drifted ashore here to your land. What manner of men are these? Is this a country of barbarians that allows its people to act in this way? Sailors have a right to the shore, and we are refused it. They make war on us and will not let us set foot on land. You may be no respecters of men. You may fear no men's arms, but think of the gods who see right and wrong and do not forget. Our king was Aeneas. He had no equal for his piety and his care for justice, and no equal in the field of battle. if the fates still protect him, if he still breathes the air of heaven, if he is not even now laid low among the merciless shades, you would have nothing to fear or to regret by taking the lead in a contest of kindness. In the land of Sicily, we have arms and cities and the great Acestes sprung from Trojan blood. Allow us to draw up our storm-battered ships, to hew timbers in your woods and shape new oars, so that we can make for Italy and Latium with joy in our hearts, if indeed we go to Italy with our comrades and our king. But if they are lost, if you, great father of the Trojans, Aeneas, if you are drowned in the sea off Libya, and there are no hopes left in Aeolus, then we can at least go back to where we came from, across the Sicilian Sea, to the place that is prepared for us, and return to King Acestes. So spoke Ilioneus and all the Trojans. All the Trojans to a man murmured in agreement. Then Dido looked down at them and made a brief answer. Have no fear, men of Troy. Put every anxious thought out of your hearts. This is a new kingdom, and it is harsh necessity that forces me to take these precautions and to post guards on all our frontiers. But who could fail to know about the people of Aeneas and his ancestry, or the city of Troy, or the valour of its men and the flames of war that engulfed it? We here in Carthage are not so dull in mind as that. The sun does spare a glance for our Tyrian city when he yokes his horses in the morning. Whether you choose to go to Great Hesperia and to the fields of Saturn, or to the land of Eryx and King Acestes in Sicily, you will leave here safe under my protection, and I shall give you supplies to help you on your way. Or do you wish to settle here with me, on an equal footing, even here, in this kingdom of Carthage? The city which I am founding is yours. Draw up your ships on the beach. Trojan and Tyrian shall be as one in my eyes. I wish only that your king Aeneas had been driven by the same south wind and were here with you now. But what I can, I shall do. I shall send men whom I can trust all along the coast and order them to cover every furthest corner of Libya in case he has been shipwrecked and is wandering in any of the woods or cities. The brave Achates and Father Aeneas had long been impatient to break out of the cloud, and at Dido's words their eagerness increased. Aeneas, said Achates, son of the goddess, what thoughts are now rising in your heart? You see, there is no danger. Our ships are safe. Our comrades are rescued. Only one of them is missing, and we saw him with our own eyes founder in mid-ocean. Everything else is as your mother Venus said it would be. He had scarcely finished speaking when the cloud that was all about them suddenly parted and dissolved into the clear sky. Aeneas stood there, resplendent in the bright light of day, with the head and shoulders of a god. His own mother had breathed upon her son and given beauty to his hair and the sparkle of joy to his eyes, and the glow of youth shone all about him. It was as though skilled hands had added embellishments to ivory or applied gilding to silver or Parian marble. Then, suddenly, to the surprise of all, he addressed the queen. The man you are looking for is standing before you. I am Aeneas the Trojan, saved from the Libyan sea. And you, Dido, alone, have pitied the unspeakable griefs of Troy. We are the remnants left by the Greeks. We have suffered every calamity that land and sea could inflict upon us. We have lost everything. And now you offer to share your city and your home with us. It is not within our power to repay you as you deserve, nor could whatever survives of the Trojan race, scattered as it is over the face of the whole wide earth. May the gods bring you the reward you deserve, if there are any gods who have regard for goodness, if there is any justice in the world, if their minds have any sense of right. What happy age has brought you to the light of life? What manner of parents have produced such a daughter? While rivers run into the sea, while shadows of mountains move in procession round the curves of valleys, while the sky feeds the stars, your honour, your name, and your praise will remain forever in every land to which I am called. As he spoke, he put out his right hand to his friend Ilioneus, and his left to Serestus. Then greeted the others, brave Gaius and brave Cloanthus. Dido of Sidon was amazed at her first sight of him, and then at the thought of the ill fortune he had endured. "What sort of chance is this," she exclaimed, "that hounds the son of a goddess through all these dangers? What power has driven you to these wild shores? Are you that Aeneas whom the loving goddess Venus bore to Dardanian Anchises in Phrygia by the river waters of the Simois? I myself remember the Greek Teucer coming to Sidon after being exiled from his native Salamis. He was looking to found a new kingdom, and was helped by my father, Belus, who in those days was laying waste the wealth of Cyprus. He had conquered the island, and it was under his control. From that day on, I knew all the misfortunes of the city of Troy. I knew your name and the names of the Greek kings. Teucer himself, your enemy, held the Teucrians, the people of Troy, in highest respect, and claimed descent from an ancient Teucrian family. This is why I now invite your warriors to come into my house. I, too, have known ill fortune like yours, and been tossed from one wretchedness to another, until at last I have been allowed to settle in this land. Through my own suffering, I am learning to help those who suffer." With these words, she led Aeneas into her royal palace, and as she went, she appointed sacrifices to be offered in the temples of the gods. Nor at that moment did she forget Aeneas's comrades on the shore, but sent down to them 20 bulls, 100 great bristling hogs' backs, and 100 fat lambs with their mothers, rich gifts to celebrate the day. Meanwhile, the inside of her palace was being prepared with all royal luxury and splendour. They were laying out a banquet in the central hall, and the draperies were of proud purple, richly worked. The silver was massive on the tables, with the brave deeds of their ancestors embossed in gold. A long tradition of feats of arms traced through many heroes from the ancient origins of the race. But a father's love allowed Aeneas's mind no rest, and he asked Achates to go quickly ahead to the ships to take the news to Ascanius and bring him back to the city. All his thoughts were on his dear son, Ascanius. He also told Achates to bring back with him, as gifts for Dido, some of the treasures that had been rescued from the ruins of Troy. A cloak stiff with gold-embroidered figures, and a dress with a border woven of yellow acanthus flowers. These miracles of workmanship had been given to Helen of Argos by her mother Leda, and she had taken them from Mycenae when she came to Troy for her illicit marriage with Paris. There was also the sceptre, which had once been carried by Ilione, the eldest daughter of Priam, a necklace of pearls, and a double gold coronet set with jewels. Achates set off for the ships in great haste to carry out his instructions. Venus, meanwhile, was turning over new schemes in her mind and devising new plans. She decided to change the form and features of Cupid, her son, and send him in place of the lovely young Ascanius to inflame the heart of the queen, driving her to madness by the gifts and winding the fire of passion round her bones. For Venus was afraid of the treacherous house of Carthage and of the double-tongued people of Tyre. The thought of the bitterness of Juno's hatred burned in her heart. And as night began to fall, and her anxiety kept returning, she spoke to the winged god of love in these words: "My dear son, Cupid, you are the source of my power. You are my great strength. Only you, my son, can laugh at the thunderbolts which my father, highest Jupiter, hurled against the giant Typhoeus. To you I come for help. I am your suppliant, begging the aid of your divine power. You well know how Juno's bitter hatred is tossing your own brother Aeneas from shore to shore round all the seas of the world, and you have often grieved to see me grieving. Now, Aeneas is in the hands of the Phoenician Dido, who is delaying him with honeyed words. And I am afraid of Juno's hospitality and what it may bring. She will not stand idle when the gate of the future is turning. That is why I am resolved to act first, taking possession of the queen, Dido, by a stratagem, and surrounding her with fire. No power in heaven will change her. I shall grapple her to myself in love for Aeneas. As for how you are to achieve this, listen now, and I shall tell you my mind. Aeneas has sent for his son, whom I so love, and the young prince Ascanius is preparing to go to the city of Carthage, bringing gifts which have survived the burning of Troy and the hazards of the sea. I shall put him into a deep sleep and hide him in one of my sacred shrines on Mount Idalium or on the heights of Kythera, so that he will not know of my scheme or suddenly arrive to interrupt it. You will have to use your cunning and take on his appearance for just one night. He is a boy like yourself, and you know him, so put on his features, and when the royal table is flowing with wine that brings release, and Dido takes you happily onto her lap and gives you sweet kisses, you can then breathe fire and poison into her, and she will not know." Cupid obeyed his beloved mother, Venus. He took off his wings and strutted about, copying Aeolus's walk and laughing. But the goddess poured quiet and rest into all the limbs of Ascanius, and holding him to the warmth of her breast, she lifted him into the high Idalian woods, where the soft amaracus breathed its fragrant shade and twined its flowers around him. Now Cupid was obeying his instructions and taking the royal gifts, amused to be escorted by Achates. When he came in, the queen was already sitting under a rich awning on a golden couch in the middle of the palace. Presently, Father Aeneas and after him the men of Troy arrived and reclined on purple coverlets. Attendants gave them water for their hands, plied them with bread from baskets, and brought them fine woolen napkins with close-cut nap. Inside were 50 serving women, whose task it was to lay out the food in order in long lines and honour the Penates by tending their fires. There were 100 other female slaves and 100 men, all of the same age, to load the tables for the banquet and set out the drinking cups. The Tyrians, too, came thronging through the doors, and the palace was full of joy as they took their appointed places on the embroidered couches. They admired the gifts Aeneas had given. They admired Iulus, the glowing face of the god and his false words, the cloak and the dress embroidered with yellow acanthus flowers. But most of all, the unfortunate Dido, doomed to be the victim of a plague that was yet to come, could not have her fill of gazing. And as she gazed, moved by the boy as much as by the gifts, the fire within her grew. After he had embraced Aeneas and hung on his neck to satisfy the great love of his father, who was not his father, he went to the queen. She fixed her eyes and her whole heart on him, and sometimes dandled him on her knee, without knowing what a great god was sitting there, marking her out to suffer. But he was remembering his mother, the goddess of the Acidalian spring, and he began gradually to erase the memory of Sychaeus, Dido's first husband. Trying to turn towards a living love, a heart that had long been at peace and long unused to passion. As soon as the first pause came in the feasting and the tables were cleared away, they set up great mixing bowls full of wine and garlanded them with flowers. The palace was ringing with noise, and their voices swelled through the spacious hall. Lamps were lit and hung from the gold-coffered ceilings, and the flame of torches routed the darkness. The queen now asked for a golden bowl heavy with jewels and filled it with wine unmixed with water. From this bowl her father Belus had drunk, and all the royal line descended from Belus. They called for silence in the great chamber as Dido spoke. "Jupiter, to you we pray, since men say that you ordain the laws of hospitality. Grant that this day may be a day of happiness for the Tyrians and the men from Troy, and may our descendants long remember it. Let Bacchus, giver of good cheer, be among us, and kindly Juno, and you, Tyrians, celebrate this gathering with welcome in your hearts." At these words, she poured a libation of wine on the table to honour the gods, and having poured it, she took it first and just touched it to her lips. She then passed it to Bitias with a smile and a challenge. Nothing loath, he took a great draught from the golden bowl, foaming to the brim, and bathed himself in wine. The other leaders of the Carthaginians did the same after him. long-haired Iopas, the pupil of mighty Atlas, then sang to his gilded lyre of the wanderings of the moon and the labours of the sun, the origin of the human race and of the animals, the causes of rain and of the fires of heaven, of Arcturus, of the Hyades, bringers of rain, of the two Triones, the oxen of the plough, why the winter suns are so eager to immerse themselves in the ocean, and what it is that slows down the passage of the nights. The Tyrians applauded again and again, and the Trojans followed their lead. So the doomed Dido was drawing out the night with all manner of talk, drinking long draughts of love, as she asked question after question about Priam and Hector, what armour Memnon, son of the Dawn, was wearing when he came, what kind of horses did Diomede have, how tall was Achilles. But no, she said, come, tell your hosts from the beginning about the treachery of the Greeks, the sufferings of your people, and your own wanderings. For this is now the seventh summer that has carried you as a wanderer over every land and sea.